From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Holy Matrimony, Till Death Do Us Part, not in America, where the divorce rate hovers around 50%, multiple marriages and no-fault divorce, cohabitation and custody. These are the currency of marriage and unmarriage today. Tonight On Point, after all the counseling, why so many American marriages are still breaking up. We begin with the latest efforts to end the nuclear standoff between the United States and North Korea. China has offered to host talks between the two countries. Jonathan Kaufman is China Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us now live from Beijing. Jonathan Kaufman, are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Thanks for being with us, Jonathan. So in the last couple of days, we've seen in quick succession the Beijing offer to host talks between North Korea and the United States. President Bush indicating that, yes, maybe there's something to talk about. North Korea is saying, no way, describing all this as a deceptive drama. We hear they've called it pie in the sky, the whole idea that there would be talks. But take us back, if you would, Jonathan, to the China piece of this. Why did Beijing finally step up and offer to host these talks? How is China seeing the whole standoff between Washington and Pyongyang?
Well, I think Beijing, like the South Koreans and like the Japanese, really want this problem to go away. And there's been a strong feeling in China, I think, for many months now, that the Americans, they feel, are mismanaging the whole situation. The view in China, and I think throughout Asia, seems to be that the North Koreans are sort of like an out-of-control teenager. And what they're really looking for is attention. And that what they want is to have negotiations with the U.S., have some security guarantees, and the only way they can get the U.S.'s attention is by waiving their nuclear weapons. So from the very start of this crisis, the Chinese have been telling the Americans that it's wrong to back the North Koreans into a corner. It's wrong to threaten sanctions. It's much better to sort of engage them in dialogue. And I think part of their frustrations, along with the South Koreans and others, has been this perception that either the U.S. doesn't really have a policy towards Korea, or the hardline policy is just pushing Kim Jong-il, further and further into a corner where he could do something unpredictable. I think what's driving a lot of this is that North Korea is China's neighbor. And if there is a destabilization in North Korea, if the economy collapses, if refugees start pouring over the border, they're going to pour into China. And that's something China is very afraid of. So in a way, in contrast to our view of China historically as this revolutionary power that always wanted to cause trouble for the U.S., China's role in all this has been to try to calm everybody down and try to get everyone in the same room to talk because they would like a peaceful solution to this as fast as possible.
And yet, you know, Jonathan, the buzz in the U.S. media and certainly out of Washington is along the lines of China is not being as helpful as it could. Yes, it may have offered a place to talk, but it hasn't leaned on North Korea. It hasn't produced the reaction that it would be capable of from Pyongyang.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think the Chinese are playing a bit of a double game as they often do in diplomacy. China does have a fair amount of influence with Korea, and I don't think they're prepared to spend all that, especially because they find the North Koreans very unpredictable. Before this crisis, there was a sort of bizarre incident back in the fall where the North Koreans appointed a Chinese businessman to run a whole section of North Korea that was to be turned into a free enterprise zone. Well, the fellow they appointed, it turns out, is a corrupt tycoon, and the Chinese ended up arresting him, and there were a lot of bad words traded back and forth. I think the Chinese feel that they just want a North Korea that is stable, get some aid. I think their biggest concern right now is that if the North Korean regime fell, they could end up with a unified South Korea right on their border. So they don't want the U.S. to expand its presence in Asia. They'd rather keep a kind of weak North Korea on their border, beholden to the Chinese and under control. So one reason why I think they haven't pushed the North Koreans is that their fear is that if Washington wins this one full out and Kim Jong-il collapses and there's a regime change, that could leave China surrounded by some very strong rivals and would increase U.S. influence in Asia, which is not something China wants.
But at this point, that is playing with fire or playing literally with nuclear weapons. Are they willing to play the great game, the backstory game here, even at the risk of North Korea moving ahead, becoming, as it's often described here, a nuclear weapons factory?
Well, I think what's hard is that the North Koreans are so unpredictable. I think even the Chinese throw up their hands in terms of dealing with the North Koreans. It's just unclear that if you push the North Koreans in one direction, they may not spin off and go off in another. So the danger of proliferation and all that is a very real one. And I think the Chinese, like everyone, are just very puzzled and have a hard time understanding how to get the North Koreans to behave in a kind of rational manner. Now, you could, in fact, say the North Koreans are being very rational, and I would argue, in fact, that they've been very skillful in terms of creating divisions between the U.S. and its allies like South Korea, between the U.S. and China, that, in fact, the North Koreans have shown a great ability to cause this kind of trouble. And I think that they're, you know, the concern is that if they're not talking, if there aren't negotiations going on, things could spin out of control. And the concern, as you suggest, may not be a nuclear war, but it may be this production of nuclear weapons that they then ship all around the world to rogue states or to rogue terrorist groups. And that's something no one wants to see. But I don't think the Chinese have any special insight into that. I think they're often as flummoxed by the North Koreans as the Americans are.
Jonathan, a final question then. At this point, the North Koreans are not taking Washington or Beijing up on the offer of talks, at least not right now. Do you see more leverage available to the Chinese? Might the Chinese lean in harder now that North Koreans have proven to be reluctant to come to talks?
You know, it's hard for me to predict that. I would suspect that if the Chinese are doing any leaning these days, they're probably leaning on the Americans, saying, look, you know, come to the negotiating table, offer them a non-aggression pact, you know, let's try to get this thing going. My sense is that the Chinese are trying to tell the U.S. that there is a way to resolve this. I'm not sure that they're right, but I think the efforts both in China and in South Korea now are very much towards trying to bring the U.S. to the bargaining table. I think in a strange way, they see the U.S. as the problem, not North Korea. Now, that may or may not be accurate, but I think the perception out here right now is that it's the U.S. which is being recalcitrant, not North Korea.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Jonathan Kaufman is China Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Beijing. An article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal says that divorce is on the rise in the United States. Economic woes and tough times are to blame, the reporter writes. We were intrigued. Turns out there's no undisputed evidence to back that up. National statistics show that the American divorce rate is drifting ever so slightly down. Still, the Census Bureau predicts that almost half of all first marriages will fail. And that, while President George Bush is pushing a marriage education initiative, rivers of Americans are in marriage counseling. There's a shrink on every corner and a self-help Save This Marriage book on every shelf, it seems. And still, Americans keep untying the knot. Why do so many American marriages end in divorce? Do Americans expect too much out of marriage? Is our high divorce rate a mark of failure or a high-priced badge of freedom? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Princeton, New Jersey is David Papineau, co-director of the National Marriage Project and a professor of sociology at Rutgers University. Good evening and welcome, David Papineau.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. And just as an interesting cultural note, David, as we weighed in with you, one of my producers told me just before the show that it was your father, Paul, who wrote the introduction to the Can This Marriage Be Saved column in the Ladies Home Journal for 25 years. So your family's been at this marriage issue for a while.
Yeah, he started his institute, which was really the first marriage counseling institute in America in 1930. And he started writing columns for the Ladies' Home Journal in early 1940s. And then 1953 is when this column, Can This Marriage Be Saved, started. And it's just celebrated its 50th anniversary, longest running column in any woman's magazine in America, I'm told.
It is a perpetual issue. And as the divorce rate has risen, I suppose the number of questions has only risen as well. David Papineau, the headline that caught our eye, we were already thinking about doing something on marriage, and then here's the Wall Street Journal headline, Divorce Makes a Comeback. What is going on with marriage and divorce in the United States? We see other numbers saying, well, it's actually drifting down a little bit. Where do things stand?
Well, first of all, they probably should fire the headline writer for the Wall Street Journal. The article didn't really have much to do with divorce increasing, and there's no evidence that the divorce rate has been increasing. In fact, it's been dropping a little bit after peaking or maybe around 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And the marriage rate's also dropping. So there are a lot of ways of calculating divorce, but of course, if marriage keeps going down, there aren't as many divorces as we've had in the past, and more people are living together too, which is outside of marriage, which is another factor.
So not as many divorces in absolute terms, but as a percentage of marriages, are you comfortable with the number that we see widely, which is somewhere between 40 and 50% of American marriages ending in divorce? Is that correct?
It is correct, and which means that in 1980, it was up between 50 and 60. In fact, one scholar calculated a rate of 60%, which is pretty off the charts. But the best estimate today is that it's around 50%, but of course that's a projection into the future, and things could turn around. That's if current divorce rates continue for a long time to come.
Now, here you are at the National Marriage Project. So the very title, I guess, suggests how you come at this. But do you see a 50% divorce rate as a national problem, a national calamity, national crisis? How do you look at it?
I think all of those, but most especially for children. I don't think that if children were involved, anybody would be too worried about the high divorce rate. You know, it wouldn't really be something that the government would get involved with. But the problem is that it means an awful lot of broken homes for children, and that's, I think, a concern for all of us.
So you see the impact on kids, let alone the impact on the psyches, I suppose, of adults. What's your interpretation of the rising divorce rate? I suppose every couple sees their issues as singular and their own, but you've looked at this across a lot of time and across a lot of people. How do you interpret the trend?
Well, the real question that's usually raised is why did the divorce rate increase so rapidly in the last 40 or 50 years? In the 50s era, it was around 20%, and now it's around 50%. So that's an enormous shift, enormous social change in a short period of time. But going back a little, the divorce rate in the United States has always been high, the highest in the world in most years, and it's just gradually been going up. And the scholars aren't in complete agreement as to all the factors involved, much less which is the most important one. But you can almost go back to the Enlightenment when personal emancipation became a big issue. And gradually, as societies have modernized, personal emancipation or radical individualism in its extreme form have become something that we strive for, and we all want that, and it means a pulling apart from institutions and social structures and so on, and marriage is just one of those. So we, you know, more and more want to go our own way, and something like marriage, which ties people together in an organized way, kind of becomes the loser.
So you see it as tied at some level to a fundamental American ideology, and yet that ideology was there from the days of the founders, not since 1950.
Well, it's not only American, it's the ideology of every modernized nation. The divorce rate is high all over the modern world. Now you get to the question of why it jumped so much between the 1950s and today, and basically it's just that all these forces accelerated. I mean, often people say that things started in the 1960s, but of course these trends go back well before that. But certainly in the 1960s and the 1970s, this kind of radical form of individualism and personal emancipation and question of authority and question of all social institutions became a very big thing for young people especially, and that sort of played out to today's high divorce rate.
Do you see a changing texture to divorce today from 10 years, from 20 years ago? Is it the same reasons, the same kind of motivations?
You know, what's really changed is marriage. If you go back a ways, marriage was a something that you just did. It was there. It was part of your life. It was strongly tied together by legal ties, by religious ties, by economic dependencies, especially the wife on the husband, of course, and those things have all weakened, and now it's basically just a love relationship, and feelings, of course, are notoriously changeable, and that's one reason why the bond that we have of marriage today is not so strong as it was in the past.
And we see them changing. David Papineau, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about divorce and why almost half of American marriages still fail. Why do? So many marriages end in divorce. Is it cultural? Is it economic? Is it just easy to do? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about divorce and why almost half of American marriages still fail. Is a high divorce rate a mark of failure or a mark of freedom? Do Americans expect too much of marriage? Are we too self-centered to accommodate another person for life? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is David Papineau. He's co-director of the National Marriage Project and a professor of sociology at Rutgers University. David Papineau, how are people looking at pushing back here? We've had years now of people talking about this as a problem, of people going into counseling and all kinds of programs, some private, some government. What's the latest thinking about how marriage might make a comeback, or is it just something that's part of history in its stability and in its prevalence of before?
Well, a national concern for divorce hasn't really caught steam until the last 10 years or so. 20, 25 years ago, people thought that it was useful in many ways in getting people out of bad marriages, and there's a certain truth to that. But now, especially in its effects on children, people are more and more concerned. So, as you indicate, there is a national movement and pressure from various sources to try to do something about it. And the question is what, if anything can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And, the best idea going at the moment is the marriage education movement, if you want to call it that. In other words, the idea that people can be taught to not only pick mates more wisely at the outset, but also stay with them and be able to communicate on an intimate level with them over the long term. And there are myriad programs out there that are attempting to do this. It's a little too soon to tell whether how effective they'll be, but it's basically the kind of marriage counseling that my father pioneered. His wasn't really therapy or anything. It was education, teaching people how they could improve their relationship.
And who's doing the education? Are we talking churches here or private
Everybody.
Counselors? Or
counselors have shifted into this. The churches are involved. There are a lot of commercial programs out there. People can go for a weekend. If you look at what the states are doing, a lot of it is setting up these programs on a mass scale.
And this is before marriage. And what's the central message of these programs?
Well, it's not only before marriage, but during marriage.
All right.
However, it's also before marriage in that some states are experimenting with bringing some of this stuff into the high schools. The basic thing is that people can possibly be taught communication and conflict resolution skills. And here, it's, of course, in marriage, it's really between men and women for the most part. So you've got to teach skills that cross the sex lines, and that's the kind of thing that is being done in the states that have big programs, and that's basically the kind of thing that the Bush administration will be pushing if it gets its way in welfare reform.
David Papineau, the Wall Street Journal had a little checklist here of things to look at in a marriage, and one of the things that they said was, do your marital problems seem insoluble? And their characterization of the latest thinking was, don't worry if they do. They said most successful couples don't solve their problems, they outlast them. Is that a message in marriage education?
It definitely is, although they don't emphasize that so much as sort of the immediate day-to-day communication that's required. But there's a view that people are bailing out of marriages too easily these days. Of course, that's a kind of glib generalization, and an awful lot of marriages that's far from the case. But the idea is that you should maybe work harder, try harder, and over the long run, things will work out. And somehow the feeling is that perhaps people in the past had a longer view. There is an interesting study which supports this idea that was done a few years back. It was a sample, I think, of about 5,000 people. And they looked at people who in year one had said that their marriages were very unhappy. And then 5 years later, they did a follow-up, and 80% of the people whose marriages were very unhappy in the first year, 5 years later, were happy. And those are the ones who stayed in their marriages. Then they looked at the ones who divorced from that category, mm-hmm. and only 50% were happy. So that's the kind of study that people point to as a possibility that maybe at least a sizable segment of people might be happier if they just stuck it out. And things, you know, marriages all have their ups and downs, and if you can outlast the downs, why, you may have it better in the end.
Bad as it may be, maybe it's better to stick with it. David Papineau, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Stephanie Kuntz. She joins us from Olympia, Washington tonight. She's national co-chair of the Council on Contemporary Families and an historian at Evergreen State College. Good evening and welcome, Stephanie Kuntz.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie, what's your view of the situation with marriage and divorce? As I understand it, you're not as worried about the divorce rate. You see just simply changing family structures, changing expectations. Do I have that right?
Well, not entirely.
Okay.
I guess the only reason that I am less concerned about figuring out how we can stop it, and especially passing laws to stop it, is because I think a certain amount of this is an inevitable historical process. And I'm very concerned. It's not, I'm perfect. I'm on my first marriage. I want it to last.
Right.
I definitely agree that people, you know, we live in a throwaway society. We throw away jobs. We throw away personal commitments,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that people would stick it out more. But as a historian, I have to say that there's some of this long-range trend is not going to go away. Family diversity is here to stay.
Why?
For one thing, the independence of women. You know, for centuries, women, marriages were held together because women had no other alternative. And for another thing, men don't need wives the way they used to. They got drip-dry shirts and take out
mm-hmm,
food.
Mm-hmm.
For yet another thing, you know, marriages, it used to be, until very, very recently, most marriages were devoted full-time to childbearing. It was a task you got through after, they didn't last all that long, on average, after the last child left home. Nowadays, people can look forward to spending 3 decades together after the last child leaves home, and rightly or wrongly, whether we agree with them or not, that changes their assessment of what they should settle for and what's a satisfactory marriage.
So what about what I take at least as fundamental assumptions here? One, in the crowd that pushes hard for marriage, is that there's fundamental fulfillment that comes from this long-term relationship that will not be found elsewhere, and secondly, that without a stable marriage at their back, children suffer.
Well, I think that it is absolutely true that in a good marriage, that's one of the most ideal things there is. What gets forgotten, and I don't think David Papineau is forgetting it, but I do think a lot of people in the so-called marriage movement are forgetting it, and I particularly worry when we get into these passing laws and doing these really, really high-intensity pep campaigns about marriage, is that people in bad marriages are worse off and more unhappy than people who are single. So a good marriage is great, but a bad marriage is not necessarily something you should tell people to stay. Yes, of course there should be counseling and therapy, but that one particular study that David referred to,
the 80% who were very unhappy, and 5 years later they were happy in their marriage if they stuck with it.
Boy, you start extrapolating from that to telling people who are very unhappy that, by golly, they'll be happy 5 years later. That is very, very dangerous, because that study doesn't, you know, there are differences between people who stay together when they say they're very unhappy.
So given all that, Stephanie Kuntz, what's your assessment? Is a 50% success or failure rate, whatever you like to call it, for marriage about right, given our historical context, or is it still some kind of shortfall from the ideal, even today?
I think we can save more marriages than we currently do. I think we can also lower the divorce rate the way that we have in some ways, technically, by preventing ill-suited couples from marrying. But once again, I think that
Who's going to do that if it's not mom, or I'm not sure who?
Well, there are programs like the PrEP program that the Bush administration wrongly thinks will encourage marriage. Actually, its main one of its main things is that it deflects people, ill-suited couples, from marrying, which may well be a good social program, but doesn't solve the larger issue that I think gets lost here. Supporting marriage and marriage counseling has to be an important thing that we do, but part of a larger multi-pronged program that recognizes that with today's rising age of marriage, with today's economic independence, family diversity is here to stay. If you don't have high divorce rates, you may have high rates of non-marriage. That's what's happened in Japan, for example.
And by family diversity, you mean all kinds of households, all kinds of structures. Stephanie Kuntz,
postpone marriage and have babies out of wedlock.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie Kuntz, David Papineau, please stand by. A lot of people want to join the conversation. I want to turn to them. Carlotta is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Carlotta. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Piggyback on the last statement there, and mm-hmm. I believe that marriage is being renegotiated as an institution. And there's a group that hasn't been talked about, and I've heard it as unwed mothers, but it's actually single mothers by choice.
By choice,
which,
right.
Which are one quarter of all live births in Western Europe and the United States right now. So I think what we're watching, since social change happens quite glacially, I think we're watching the response of a generation of females who have, rather than taking an ill-suited relationship and wanting to act upon the biological time clock
mm-hmm.
or the procreation imperative or just to produce new taxpayers for George Bush, they're doing it by themselves. They can do that economically. The impact of the women's movement is in here, as well as, I believe, those women who went through divorces in the 70s and 80s and will not bring children into the world in that situation.
And how does that sit with you, Carlotta? It sounds like you welcome this development.
I'm a sociologist, and mm-hmm. I look at this. I really don't have a heavy-duty valence. I just watch.
Mm-hmm.
I just watch. It just seems to be that this particular statistic hadn't been brought in yet, so that's why I called.
We thank you for sharing it with us, and for your call, Carlotta. David Papineau, how about it? Does this line up with your understanding, one-fourth of all live births, single mothers by choice?
Well, I doubt that it's quite that high, and in Western Europe, especially, most of the out-of-wedlock births, the people are living with somebody. They're just not married, especially in Scandinavia. But in general, I think it's a trend which is not to be welcomed, mainly because it simply discards fathers from the whole equation of child-rearing. And I think that's a very dangerous trend. Fathers are very important, and I never met the child yet that didn't want to grow up with a father. So, you know, one can certainly understand in cases where a woman is getting older and there's no man inside and she has a child, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that it's something that society should encourage in any way.
Stephanie Kuntz, what about it? You speak of family diversity. Do we have to approach this in a value judgment mode? Single mothers by choice, good, bad, or neutral?
Well, I think that it is a question of something that is happening now, and could we really turn it around? You know, when we made the transition to wage labor from self-sufficient farms, there were a lot of losses involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you couldn't just tell people, you know, by golly, stay on your farm and ignore the market society. And I personally think that family diversity is very analogous to that. That these kinds of changes are happening. We don't need to encourage them, but at the same time, we need to recognize that if they're there, the right research question today isn't what is the very best ideal family form, but how can we help every family build on its strengths and minimize its weaknesses?
And the kind of biological suggestion that a father might have something to do with the child, outmoded?
I don't think it's outmoded, but I do think that there are going to be women who make that choice or who have that choice made for them
mm-hmm.
and who then what do we do with that?
By men who move on, right?
Exactly. And so we have to help them work their family life out the best, too. I have no objection to anybody saying, you know, let's encourage two-parent families. And incidentally, two-parent families seems to work better for kids even when they're same-sex two-parent families. But
well, there's certainly more hands to change the diaper. David's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I want to address, I'm a divorced dad,
okay. And
a very devoted one at that, by the way. And, you know, I feel as though since I got divorced, there's a heavy bias. We talk about how important fathers are, but there's a real heavy bias against fathers post-divorce. And a couple things I'll point to that, you know, personal issues. One is that, you know, like after I moved out and I had to find a place to live, you know, oh, you're divorced? Well, okay, you know, and you're standing there next to other families that are married. You may be better off financially when you're trying to rent a place, but you won't get it.
You mean discrimination in the rental market?
Yeah, but that's just one. So I'm just really talking about the general issue of bias against
the attitude.
Really important. But the bigger issue, and I think the more important one, is this one where there's this thing about deadbeat dads. And a deadbeat dad, of course, everybody knows, is somebody who doesn't pay their child support. But I have a question. What about deadbeat mothers? What happens when a father pays the child support, but the mother doesn't pass that support on to the child? There's no accounting. There's nothing. There's no follow-up. Nobody looks at that particular part of the issue. So deadbeat dads, people who don't pay their child support, the state comes after them. Their wages get garnished. Their driver's license gets revoked.
But do you see the possibility for a kind of deadbeat mom as well? Well, let that issue stand for a moment. David, let me ask you, with everything that you've seen on the other side of a divorce, does it make you wish you would have just stayed in the marriage?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, you have to say, you know, what are the reasons for getting divorced? And for me, it was a question of how can I be the most effective parent? And I felt as though I couldn't be the most effective parent by staying in the marriage. And I certainly felt it was not a good example to set for my children to show that if you're, you know, very unhappy and things aren't working out, that the thing to do is just stay there. You know, I wanted my children to know that they were, you know, that they should settle for the very best thing, that life is a finite experience and they have to try to spend as much of it as possible, as happy as possible.
David, thank you for your call. David Papineau, there you hear, I guess, what you were pointing to. People are looking for fulfillment, for personal emancipation and deep fulfillment in the marriage. Our caller David says, if it's not there, don't stay.
Yes, well, this caller is speaking, of course, from a kind of a father's rights position, which has become very, very prominent and vocal in America. And it's the issues are extremely difficult to resolve. There somehow is the belief that once a divorce takes place, you can kind of recreate the original family in some form. But
you mean the father visiting on weekends or whatever?
Right. Well, even more than that, joint custody somehow. But nothing really works very well. I mean, if you have joint custody and the father moves away, the kid is going back and forth. I mean, the ideal situation is if the mother and the father are still on very good terms, live right next door to each other, and the kid can go maybe back and forth on a regular. But, I mean, that's a pipe dream. So it comes to the issue of what then do you do, and that's what the judges have to decide. And all too often, I think that maybe not all too often, but commonly the decision is that the children should stay put, and that means they have to live with one partner or the other, and that often means the woman, and thereby lies the whole issue of the father's rights movement.
And we hear all of that. Stephanie Kuntz, I know we have to let you go, but thank you for raising the whole vista of family diversity tonight and being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I enjoyed it.
Stephanie Kuntz is national co-chair of the Council on Contemporary Families and an historian at Evergreen State College. We're talking about divorce and why almost half of American marriages still fail. Is divorce so common that it's no longer damaging to kids, or is it always damaging? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, I wish that we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about divorce and why almost half of American marriages still fail. It is a complex ecosystem out there today. Singles, would you rather date someone who's divorced or someone who's never been married? And what about living together before marriage? Does it help or does it hurt? Can government policy change divorce rates? Is it time, for example, to end no-fault divorce? Or do you want the not loose? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by David Papineau from Princeton, New Jersey, co-director of the National Marriage Project, and now from Arlington, Virginia, by John Crouch. He's a divorce attorney and executive director of Americans for Divorce Reform. Good evening and welcome, John Crouch.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. John, you've got a different perspective here, and as I understand it, you think it's a bit too easy for Americans to get divorced. You'd like to change that.
Yes, easy is the wrong word because it is a very difficult, horrible process that people go through. I've been involved in a lot of different attempts by the legal profession to improve divorce, and I've come to realize how difficult that is, and And I think trying to reduce divorce might ultimately be a more effective way of reducing the damage that divorce does to people.
So are you saying that divorce laws currently give an incentive to divorce or disincentive to stay married?
Well, I mean, a big reason that a lot of people divorce is simply because they can. The laws that we've had since about 1970, and in some states for far longer than that, it's not that they're no fault, it's that they are unilateral divorce laws. They changed the basic rules of marriage to say that either person can decide that the marriage is going to be over, and it is. And that doesn't just change what happens in a divorce. It means that neither person can trust the other person's commitment that much, and so when problems crop up, both of them have to be looking for the exit doors.
How would you like to see that changed?
Well, what I don't want is to simply go back to whatever the law was in the 1950s, and that's not what the divorce reform movement is trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to go part of the way back and try a middle course that we never really started down, which is emphasizing mutual consent and the right to contract in arranging what your marriage is going to be.
In advance or in the process of wedding?
Well, to say that the basic rule is that you end a marriage by mutual consent, by agreeing on the terms in which you're going to end it, and so you know that that your marriage is a contract that the other person isn't that likely to abandon you. Of course, there's a couple of exceptions. There are very bad things that people do to each other in marriages, and you do need some kind of fault system for cases where mutual consent doesn't work.
John Crouch, are you describing this as people obligated by law upon coming in to kind of sign up to the terms of the marriage, and then there would not be the option of, well, I just don't feel like being married any longer?
That's right. Unless you made a very clear-eyed choice at the beginning to say we are going to have a marriage that you can get out of very easily when either person wants to. People go into both marriage and into divorce without any idea what they really entail. They have fantasies about marriage, and they also choose divorce based on fantasies about what's going to happen with property and custody, and they're stripped of those illusions in the divorce process.
David Papineau, I want to bring you in here. Can you imagine this flying in America in 2003, a kind of laying down the law? You're going to agree to these terms, and you're not going to have a divorce unless one of these explicit promises is broken.
Well, I think another way to look at it is to think about covenant marriages. And that's been put into effect in a number of states, as John well knows. And there you're choosing in advance voluntarily to take on a restricted divorce system if the marriage should break up.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be reasonable. Unfortunately, not many people have taken up on it yet in those states, but maybe it's too early to tell.
Well, don't Americans really want to keep their options open? I mean, what percentage, John Crouch, realistically do you think would voluntarily enter into that kind of contractual binding marriage?
That is what marriage was for 5,000 years, and in fact it was far stronger, and people chose it, and I think they appreciated the fact that they're not only giving something up, they're getting a commitment in return, and they're getting a commitment that they and their children can rely on.
Well, there's the voice that says, back to the future. John Crouch, thank you very much for joining us tonight. John Crouch is Executive Director of Americans for Divorce Reform. Connie's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Connie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could address the issue of age stratification for that 50% statistic. My understanding is that if you break it down by decades, people in their 20s might be divorcing at a rate of more like 80%.
It's an interesting question. Let me put it straight to David Papineau. David, how about it?
Well, that is a figure over the lifetime of a marriage, and if a marriage is going to end in divorce, half of the divorces take place by the eighth year.
Does it matter what age people are when they begin?
Seventh. Yeah, I mean, the younger they are, of course, the more likely the divorce. And I suspect that for teenagers marrying, it may be easily as high as 80%. And if you look at, on the other hand, a couple that's been married for 40 years, their rate is extremely low.
Connie, are you thinking there that it might make sense to marry later for a more stable marriage, or where are you poking with that?
Well, certainly that's an issue, but more than that, I was thinking it's a pretty dismal outlook if you're young.
Yeah.
In terms of marriage, I'm going through a separation right now.
And how old are you, Connie?
31. I was married for 8 years.
8 years, you hit the statistical median right on the nose.
Exactly.
Well,
interesting.
Good luck to you, Connie, and thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You know, Tom, I wanted to say
one
further thing about the John Crouch issue, mm-hmm. and that is I think we've come to the point in this society where we really have to distinguish marriages with children and marriages without children.
Meaning if you have children, you're going to incur a different responsibility.
Right. You should have a longer waiting period. Maybe the ground should be a little bit different. And you know, in times past, almost all marriages had children, so you didn't think about that. Mm-hmm. But today we have millions of marriages that have no children, and in those cases, it's not clear what the public interest is in sort of keeping the people together.
But then can you imagine the Bush administration actually standing up for something like that?
No, I can't. But
and if not this administration, then who?
Well, it's something I think that we should talk about. I mean, the marriage and divorce laws are always up for debate. In fact, there's a big set of changes on the table right now from the American Law Institute that are being considered. But I think it would be a very important step to distinguish between those two types of marriages.
Well, there you go. If you have kids, it would be different. David Papineau, we're out of time, but it's been great having you, and I thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
David Papineau joined us from Princeton, New Jersey. He's co-director of the National Marriage Project and professor of sociology at Rutgers University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a descendant of Leo Tolstoy writes about a futuristic Russia. This is On Point. With a playful voice and a biting wit, Tatiana Tolstaya, great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy, recalls the great Russian satirists in her debut novel, The Sphinx, set in Russia 200 years after an unspecified but disastrous event called The Blast. The Sphinx unfolds in a city ruled by a tyrant who plagiarizes literary masterpieces as the society's sole writer. The tongue-in-cheek novel alludes to the history and present of Tatiana's mother country. We spoke with Tatiana Tolstaya today about some of the issues being addressed behind the imaginative setting of her novel.
It's a man who lives 200 years after the blast, and he's an avid reader. Books are not allowed exactly in this society. You can read only the state-approved books. So he gets involved with all his dreams, ideas. He discovers the whole world inside the books. But they are still no good for him because he doesn't have something inside that allow him to really understand what the books are about. We do not know exactly what the blast stands for, and it is made on purpose because it is some kind of breakdown of the world as we know it. Could be an explosion, could be a revolution, could be breakdown of a certain regime. So it is a society that has to live in the circumstances when the things as they knew it are gone. They have to start from square one. Is Moscow, actually, and this Moscow, its name is forgotten, changed names in this 200-year period, and now it is called Fyodor Kuzmichsk, after the name of one of the tyrants who is presently ruling in Moscow. But one can read it on a wider basis, because any city has its history, any country has its history, and we forget lots of people who lived before us and lots of things that happened before our time, and we lose connection with these people. So one of the themes of this novel, I would say, is the loss of connections between old and new men and women, rich people and poor people, old times and present. imaginary cat-like creature, say, and my protagonist is deadly afraid of that creature. In his mythology, it is something that you cannot see, that creeps in the night, and that takes your soul away, takes your mind away, takes your personality away. That is something that turns a human being back into a beast in a way. And culture, widely speaking, is something that lets us get away from that beast towards more humanly attitude towards each other. About Russian history, especially in the last 15 years or so, the more I see that there is a certain pattern that wouldn't go away. When I read some books on Russian history of 16th century and then on the beginning of the 19th century and then from my own life, I see that there are so many things that repeat themselves. The structure of the society, the way people react to the authorities, the way people react to each other. So what I was mostly interested in showing that whatever changes, nothing changes. The more it changes, the more you can recognize the same country you used to know. And it took me about 14 years to accomplish a novel, because when I started it in 86, the whole world was different. We just had the beginning of Perestroika, and we had Gorbachev, who just came. But it took 14 years to make sure, you know, that nothing changes. The whole world turned upside down. Now I'm going to read a little excerpt from my novel. It's my protagonist, whose name is Benedict. He thinks about women and about how one needs a woman. A Golubchik definitely needs a woman. How can you get along without a woman? Benedict went to see the widow woman Marfushka about the woman business. Maybe once or twice a week, but he'd always go to see Marfushka. You couldn't exactly say that she was pretty. In fact, her whole face was sort of crooked, like someone hit her with a battle axe. And one eye wandered. Her figure wasn't all that great either. She was shaped like a turnip. But she didn't have any consequences. She was rounded out where she ought to be and caved in where she ought to be. After all, he didn't visit her to look at her, but to take care of the woman business. If looking's what you want, well, you can go out on the street and look until your eyes pop out. This was different. Like Fyodor Kuzmich, Glory B. wrote, not because she shines so bright, but because with her you need no light. You don't need any light with Marfushka. You are better off without it. As soon as Benedict got to her place, he'd blow out the candle and they'd start rolling around, twisting and turning and loving it up every which way. Squatting and straddling this way and that and hopping around the izba. Goodness gracious, what kind of things got into your head sometimes? When you are sitting alone, thinking your own thoughts, stirring your cabbage soup, you'd never hop around the izba or stand on your head. It would be silly. But when you visit a woman, you can't help herself. Your pants come off right away, and there's jokes and giggles. Woman's nature, or rather her body, is just made for jokes.
Tatyana Tolstoya is great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy. Her English translation of her debut novel, The Slinks, is being released today in the United States. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is